So, may we start?
1, 2, 3, 4!
So may we start? It's time to start. My time to start.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Third Act Podcast, episode number 235. I'm your host, Christian Estabrook, and with me, as always, is Jericho Serrona.
Just over here, getting glazed with the Glaze Boys.
And Armando Rivera.
Glaze it up, fellas.
All right, dear listeners, we want to remind you, of course, all of us here at the Third Act Podcast, we watch lots of films, we have lots of opinions on those films, and we're just pretentious enough to think that you care. And this episode, we have only one goal, and that's to get glazed. We're talking Jonathan Glazer, we're talking The Zone of Interest, nothing else on the to-do list, no recently watched, no pairing film. It's just, I got my glazed donuts. I got my windows reglazed this weekend. Guys, I'm ready to go.
I'm good, man. I'm just over here glazing. So we good.
Yeah. Does anyone have a glazed look in their eyes?
Well, I'm not stoned for this episode. I'm here sober.
I think Robert did when I was giving my interpretation of the final episode of The Curse, but. Yeah, no one here is glazed over right now.
Well, spoiler alert that we did The Curse and Zone of Interest episodes on the same night. Listener, now you're seeing how the sausage is made.
Oh, gosh.
And we got to
very much like The Curse, you know, peek behind the curtain of how the sausage is made or how the glazed donut is made.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, we got to get all these glazer puns out of the way. Get glazed, glazed donuts. Because, guys, I don't think there's too many jokes in Zone of Interest. So we're going to have to bring down the energy here a little bit, I think, in order to have a Zone of Interest conversation. I guess real quick, we should check in on Glazer. Guys, it's been a minute. The last Jonathan Glazer movie, Under the Skin in 2013, was it all three of our number one movies of that year? It was pretty close. I think it came close to running the board.
It's like two or three for me, I think.
Okay.
It was definitely my number one.
And Jericho's number one and almost there for Armando.
I saw the premiere in Telluride.
Sure.
And no one knew what the hell it was. And was blown away then. And it still holds up. I think it's, I did when my website was, online. I did like a best films of the last decade or whatever. And I think it was maybe number two. I think it was behind Act of Killing. I'm not sure. It was close between those two.
So I
rewatched it, I think, last year. So it's a phenomenal motion picture.
I haven't rewatched Under the Skin in a while. I've actually watched both Sexy Beast and Birth more recently than Under the Skin, which I like both of those, and both of those hold up, I think. I'm sure Under the Skin does. I just haven't gotten to it recently. I also started looking at some of the other stuff Glazer did since I saw The Zone of Interest about a month ago now. Watched a couple like music videos. I watched this one on Criterion. Jericho, have you seen... What the fuck is it called? The Fall? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I tipped you off on that. It popped up on Criterion, so
yeah,
we had a discussion off mic about it, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, yeah, I watched that recently as well. So doing a little extra glazing here and there, but I don't know, Armando. Do we have to get into any specifics? We're all huge Glazer heads over here, yeah, right? It kind of goes without saying.
Yeah, those are top three, Underskin's top three for me. It's Sexy Beast, that's the Kingsley one, right?
Yep.
I saw it. That was pretty good. I really don't remember. I don't really, what was the other, the Kidman one? I haven't seen that. Are you all over the moon for that one. Is that a must for me? I haven't seen that one.
Birth? Yeah, gotta see it. Gotta see it. Yeah, it's great performance.
It's worth seeing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Good movie for sure. All right. So laying the context here a little bit, we delayed our best of 2023 episode long enough for Jericho and I to see The Zone of Interest, which usually happens pretty much every year. There's always like one more movie like, oh, we got to wait for the Paul Thomas Anderson. We got to wait for the Glazer. We got to wait for American Sniper, whatever it is. We got to wait for one more movie. That last one was a joke, everybody. We got to wait for one more movie before we wrap up the year. This year, that movie was The Zone of Interest. I saw it first. I went out to San Francisco, saw it right around the time it expanded in this area. Big fan, waiting on, obviously, Jericho and I also had our falls, which we talked about on the best of episodes. So took a while for us to both be able to see that. And I don't know, big glaze heads around here, got the glazed donuts. I didn't know for sure, but I thought we'd be roughly in the same territory on Zone of Interest. I had as my number three film of the year behind Killers of the Flower Moon and The Boy and the Heron. So way up there, big fan of the Zone of Interest. I shared some of my thoughts on that best of episode. Jericho shared some points of disagreement. Well, no, not points, just a general air of disagreement. And then we kind of shelved it from there. So I think there's, to some degree, going to be some disagreements that are going to come up. Anxious to hear what those are. But first, Armando, I don't have any hints of what your take is like, and the listeners don't either. They know to some degree what I think of this movie. There's hints at what Jericho thinks about this movie, but you're the wild card. You're out there. We don't know what's going on in that Rivera head of yours. So lay it on me, The Zone. Oh, wait, I didn't even set up the movie. My bad. The Zone of Interest, directed by Jonathan Glazer, starring Christian Friedel, Sandra Hüller, and Johann Kauthaus. The synopsis: Auschwitz Commandant Rudolf Haas and his wife Hedwig strive to build a dream life for their family in a house and garden beside the camp. That's the setup here. This is based on a novel of the same name, which does similar things. I've not read that novel, but I read up on it after seeing the movie. The novel actually does a similar thing that the movie does, except for it makes the characters in the movie more anonymous, makes them somewhat fictional. They use different names, whereas Glazer went back and used real names such as Rudolf Haas, a real person in history, to tell this story in movie form. So almost the entire movie takes place at this idyllic home just outside the walls of Auschwitz. We get a lot of the day-to-day family inner workings. We spend time in the garden, swimming, cooking meals or eating meals that servants have cooked for you, reading bedtime stories, just a lot of normal domestic life, but with the horrors of Auschwitz always being able to be heard over the course of this runtime. That's the majority of it. There's a couple big breaks in form and style here and there that I think we'll probably get into, but that's the setup for what this movie is. And Armando, without any further ado, I got to know, what's your take on The Zone of Interest?
Right. I know there was a Glazer film on the horizon, which I don't know if he's kind of, I don't know, there's some films I'm missing, but not super prolific. I don't know if he's the new Malick here, but where there's not too many, but when there is one, it's momentous. And certainly there was some pretty, one of our things we like to do is joke about, our own faux quotes or hyperbolic reviews or promos. And, we're just seeing things like, so one of them I think was like one of the most monumental films of all time or something like that. It was, so I think for a while I didn't really know what this one was about. And, when I heard it was kind of revolving around a Holocaust true story, that's well tried in a territory. But, anytime a filmmaker like Glazer with a singular vision and you know, formidable aesthetic style comes along, you're going to be in the back for your girl. What's the angle here? What's he going to do with this? It's not going to really be more of the same, and it's not. But I will say though, I was surprised, not surprised. I wasn't exactly sure where you all, how Atlantis is, was watching it. And I'll say that before I go into the minutia of it, I admired this film a good deal. I was not completely over the moon for it as this unassailable masterpiece to put right alongside Under the Skin. It's very well made. I mean, we're in the hands of a sure-handed director who is not even really misstepping at all. The form, the compositional talents here, the cast. I mean, the cast is also excellent here. The unsentimental tone, the kind of the juxtaposition of imagery that's unnerving. The lack of, I mean, there is a bit of a narrative here in terms of Rudolph's, I guess you'd say, career arc. To use the term career loosely, I guess it is his career. But I think though that in terms of, I'm open, definitely open to, I've been swayed by two before at times, maybe unlock certain things that I am not picking up on or didn't respond to. I haven't watched this a second time. Yeah, I was impressed. Yeah, by the tone, the patience, the sheer filmmaking involved here, thematically and in terms of what was coming across, it did feel a little bit long to me. And this is like what, hour 45, not really a long film at all. I just don't think, I felt like whatever points were being made, almost could have been just like a brilliant short film, but stretched this long. As impressive as some of the flourishes here were, and Christian, I think you made a quick reference to some of the bricks from form here, which I thought were arresting. I was, the moments of the girl on her bike. I think she was throwing apples around, leaving them behind were haunting. I didn't need those to pay off. I mean, I kind of get the kind of idea what's going on there. There was one. And you're like, okay, this is Glazer. He's kind of doing more of his thing now. He's really getting into it. Is he? And never, I like that it doesn't necessarily go full on into like, this is the Holocaust. This is a Holocaust story, but Glazer doing Under the Skin. So he doesn't go there. He teases that, right? And there's another shot late, which I thought was genius. And it's just this, like, you just get this moment of like this red screen, right? I mean, blood suffering, just a couple seconds there. Do you know exactly what it is? No, but you know enough. We get the point, right? It swarms over you. It hits you. Brilliant moment. The stuff with the girl haunting. And it looks just so unnerving and just so, creatively shot. It's such a departure. It's jarring, but just in that great way that sometimes happens. The performances here are strong. The guy, I'm not too familiar with this guy. And of course we know, Sandra Hüller. I think there's nice touches here too, in terms of we get, humanizing moments of them just, right. Just like, laughing, enjoying each other's company, where they're monstrous people in many ways, but we don't get this like just cliche of this completely loveless transactional marriage, or it's not exactly, there's moments of humanism, not in a sympathetic way, but shading these characters, the complexity of kind of their marriage, how she can, you know, it's not this, I can live without you. I can't live without you. I'll go anywhere you want. You know, there's interesting dynamics that play here. And the way things are shot, just the structure, the geography, the proximity, obviously it's not very subtle, right? Even as it's kind of, you know, you have, you know, enjoying giving tours of this beautiful garden, the luxuries, the mistreated servants, all the while we see the smoke in the background, right? We know what's going on. And also, you know, later on in the film, I do like the way it closes. Very memorable ending too, spoilers, but you know, going ahead to the museum and then this kind of displacement, deja vu parallel kind of things going on with him, you know, that vomiting moment, which I don't know if the vomiting thing, maybe that's a little bit too on the nose kind of a thing. And I, you know, I kind of read some more of the story, and, you know, there's a lot here that is, you know, kind of following things exactly as they happened. So I just really admired the style, the approach of Glazer. I did feel like I kind of got the point, and there wasn't really much beyond that other than, yes, these people carry on, with these grotesque, you know, unspeakable things, this unspeakable chapter, while enjoying these comforts. I don't know if that in itself made for like this sustained brilliance over an hour and 45 minutes, but it's still a very good film. Maybe I'm on the wrong side. I mean, there's just been some extremely hyperbolic things said about this, which I guess a filmmaker like Glazer can bring that out of people. So I don't know. Maybe I'm in the minority here, and which by no means is a negative review. I'm just saying it wasn't quite on that almost God tier that some people have been, talking about it as.
Need Robert back in the Skype call to be on my side of things here.
yeah.
Robert's very high on this one, as I am. I'll go quickly since I said some things on that best of episode already. But real quick on the girl with the apples that Armando was talking about. This is actually, I've heard, brought up as a criticism of the movie because there are things that that play better with some research done after the movie that you can't really get just within the context of watching the film. That girl is based off a real person in history who has done that. The reason it was shot that way is because the movie has no artificial lighting that's used. And in fact, most of how it's shot is cameras that were positioned around the house and garden, and then they would just be running with no crew on set. So they were just capturing this footage, letting the actors go kind of live in that set, and then kind of finding it afterwards, and then figuring out how to shoot those scenes of the girl, you know, shooting it at night, you know, without any type of light in the scene that could be used. How would you be able to know what's going on? And the solution they came up with was shooting it with a thermal camera in order to do that, but still not have any artificial light in the film. But the effect of that, I think, is the movie can almost kind of lull at times. It's very much an example of, you know, something brought up many times, the banality of evil. This is that writ large for large stretches, but it does have these points in the filmmaking or in the sound design or in the minimal score from Mika Levy here again, doing another score with Glazer, that comes in and kind of jolts you out of it. And I think the those nighttime sequences shot the way they are is another example of that, which is welcome as a way to kind of break up what we get from a lot of the rest of the runtime here. I think what works for me most since watching The Zone of Interest, it's been about a month for me since I first watched it, wanted to get a rewatch in, but it's not available at home and it's only playing in a couple of theaters near me. So I'd probably have to drive like 45 minutes an hour each way to rewatch it. So couldn't make that happen, unfortunately. But what's been sticking with me, the thing that connected with me so hard on first viewing to show up on my list and things like that, is the way this film kind of explores how to depict evil. And this is probably something very subjective or whatever, but watching so many movies and becoming inured to a certain degree of how, you know, especially kind of mainstream modern movies use violence and use villains or depict bad guys, even depict Nazi characters in and of themselves, there's a temptation to depict people who do horrible things as really larger than life or monstrous. That's almost even, I think, kind of like a way of coping is processing, like making it so big you can't really wrap your arms around it. But what I think The Zone of Interest does so well is bring you back to the place that people who do horrible things are people. People who do absolutely heinous things go home and eat a dinner and play with their kids and do that sort of thing. And for multiple reasons, things that are happening today, while not exactly Auschwitz at all times, there are connections that could be made to modern times and finding the balance between you have your normal life and there's horrible things happening just in the distance, or horrible things are being done by people, and how do we resist that temptation to just look at them as monsters but see them as humans and people who are capable of this, just as everyone is, and it's not a specific cursed, damned, evil select few that do these types of things. That's within everyone. And I don't know, that's I see The Zone of Interest as for me like a helpful corrective to see evil depicted in this way. There's also very few experiences that I can think of that really are similar at all to watching The Zone of Interest. There's also a question of this type of dealing with something like Auschwitz in film. How are you going to do that? How can you possibly portray the real life horrors that happened in any way that's at all faithful or appropriate to make in movie version? And I think people have tried to come up with different answers to those questions in all sorts of ways, stylistically, or what the story of the film like chooses to focus on over the course of it. But it's a difficult one. It's not an easy thing to figure out how to tell a story of Auschwitz or the story of Nazis during World War II or any stories that can be contained within that larger story. It's always going to be something very difficult. But watching this and not seeing any of the actual atrocities on screen, but them always being close and near and feeling the weight of that without having it to be depicted, there's not much that I can really think of that achieves a different thing. This movie really knocked me sideways, and I was quiet for a long time after watching it. Wasn't sure exactly how to even talk about it after having seen it. And I just found it, you know, the movie doesn't really pick me back up. So it's kind of a punishing experience, I think. But in searching for things that for me, accomplish different things or connect in different ways, that was another thing that I really responded to in The Zone of Interest, is just what I think is maybe a unique experience, not anything that I can say is quite like what Zone of Interest does. And maybe there's all sorts of examples I haven't seen or they're not coming to mind immediately. I mean, honestly, it was, we talked about Under the Skin and The Act of Killing earlier in the episode. There's also a connection, I maybe, between The Act of Killing and the Zone of Interest towards the very end of the film. May even be commentary or repurposing that. Like, I don't know what the intentions behind that were, but this is maybe an attempt of achieving something along the lines of The Act of Killing, but in a narrative film instead of a documentary film. That's maybe the closest, but I don't think it's exactly the same. So that's also what's sticking with me when it comes to the Zone of Interest. Jericho, would love to hear more of your thoughts on the Zone of Interest.
Oh, wait, let me just say that made me think for a second, because in Act of Killing, I think the main guy, Anwar, right? I think he like throws up at some point, right?
The ratching scene, it's a direct, to me, it was a direct fallback to the Act of Killing, because there's this idea of the physical body betraying you. Like, even if you're emotionally disconnected or compartmentalizing, your physical body can actually react. And film, it's like, a physical reaction that the Rudolf Haas character is having, which is similar to what Anwar, who's a genocidal killer, murderer in Joshua Oppenheimer's The Act of Killing, has a similar moment. So,
and I haven't even fully have made my peace with the end of this film, which, you know, does things very different from earlier stretches of it. I mean, I guess if that is meant as a reference point, The Act of Killing, you know, I guess it is this catching up with him moment that's being shown. But it also wasn't entirely clear to me exactly what was being said there, because like how Jericho just described is this physical response, but seeing those other images seems like it's conveying a mental toll, but I don't think that character in that moment was experiencing that, unless that cross cutting is like a supernatural element or something, some out of body experience that he's having that's causing that reaction. So I don't know. I'm not even entirely sure what the last few minutes or so of this movie is. I don't know if either of you can elucidate more of that for me. That's part of also me wanting to rewatch and see how some of these things settle. But I found it fascinating and really interesting and valuable regardless, even without having some of those answers. But sorry, Jericho, I'll kick it to you once more.
Yeah, so we know from the best of 2023 show where Christian had The Zone of Interest as his number three film, and I did not mention it, and it's not in my top 30. So Armando, I don't think you're going to get any swaying from me. And initially after I saw this, I had very complicated feelings. I was like kind of wrestling with it, but as further away I get from it, the less it works for me. I think individual elements like the sound design and Miko Levy's atonal score are quite extraordinary, regardless of the film. Like, just on their own merits, those things are truly exceptional from like a technical standpoint. The problem with any filmic depiction of the Holocaust has always been one of representation versus exploitation. Christian got into this a little bit. How much do you show of the horrors? How much do you withhold? And does showing or not showing even matter, since no depiction of something so monstrous can ever replicate the truth? So if you are going to tackle this subject, you can either go the sensitive, artful direction that also has a beating heart, like Spielberg's Schindler's List, or you can blur the line between depiction and exploitation, like the film Son of Saul, or you can go full on comedy farce like Jojo Rabbit, or somewhere in between drama and sentimental kitsch, like Jacob of the Liar and Life is Beautiful. So there's this whole like there's a whole spectrum that's been attempted with this subject. Glazer chooses an approach that's closer to, I think, to Son of Saul in how the horror is all about what you don't see. Instead, in this film, you're just embedded with this family, right? Living on the other side of Auschwitz. You only hear the sounds of unspeakable suffering from the other side. And I think the central conceit is effective in terms of allowing our collective knowledge of history fill in the gaps. You don't need to see the atrocities, for example, to get it. We know enough about, well, hopefully, audiences know enough about this where that's not going to be an issue. However, I think many are claiming that this is a vision of the banality of evil. But I think the characters that we're actually focused on are not banal characters. Nazi and SS commander of Auschwitz, Rudolf, and his wife, Hedwig, are definitely evil, but they are not banal. They are essentially profiting off the murder of Jews. The system that they are a part of fuels their wealth and their success directly. So this isn't the same as people recognizing evil and then turning the other way or being afraid of going against the status quo. They are well aware of the actions. They're choosing to compartmentalize, but they're also reaping the benefits of what's happening at the camp directly. I think maybe if the film took place like near the camps with another German family who had no direct relationship with Auschwitz as a bureaucratic structure, then the idea of complicity and implicating the audience would have landed more effectively for me. The concept of domesticated family going about their mundane domestic business while horror reigns nearby is an audacious idea, but I think in this context, like if Glazer's going to focus on this specific family, this specific Nazi officer, I think it would only, or this family, it would only work under this circumstance if it was told primarily from the children's perspective, because I think following Rudolph and Hedwig around is mostly pointless. And then Glazer treats everything with such like solemn self-seriousness in terms of the aesthetic choices. I mean, hence the subject matter. There's really no room for us to read anything into the film that we already don't understand about the events. And then in terms of the aesthetics, he's using a lot of the same techniques that he used in Under the Skin. So why doesn't it work for me here? Well, for one thing, I think the detached camera placement, the pseudo documentary positioning of the cameras all around the house, and the use of sound is itself just as artificial or contrived as some of the more, let's say, problematic scenes in something like Schindler's List. Like, why does a detached, ominous tone mean it's more respectful or truthful than one that adds more overtly sentimental or artful flourishes? I think Glazer is drawing just as much attention to the directing as Spielberg did in Schindler's List, but I feel his film is more lifeless and fake. The subject matter is doing all the emotional lifting, but the aesthetic, kind of like paring back the simplistic like minimalism, actually had the opposite effect on me that was intended. I was less immersed and I was just more aware of how constructed everything was and how detached it was and what the aesthetic was and what Glazer was doing with the camera. I mean, obviously this is at least partially on purpose because Glazer makes no attempts at making this feel like it's a period piece aside from the costumes and the sets. It's very digital looking. It's very modern looking the way it's shot. I think the aim is probably to show how these horrors don't have a time capsule written into them. They can happen during any time period. They're happening right now, as Christian mentioned. Which is fine. I accept that. But I do feel the artier flourishes, like the scenes of the young girl gathering the apples filmed in that photo negative thermal effect. It's kind of like, it's almost a direct inversion of the red dress in Schindler's List. It's like the same concept, but only like inverted. And speaking of Spielberg, there's moments here involving ashy human remains feeding soil and polluting nearby rivers. They're almost similar to sequences in something like War of the Worlds, if you remember that Spielberg vehicle.
Sure.
Which some of that imagery, shockingly, was more effective to me on an emotional level, because I think it was connected to a thematic vision. But Glazer, I think, is resting on his distance from the material. And you'd assume this would equal more respect and faith in the audience, but I think it's actually the opposite, at least for me. It signals a lack of trust in the audience, in us, to handle the pure terror, the emotional despair that these events actually conjure in us. I think this extends to the score by Michael Levy, which I praise, and which in isolation is amazing. But do we really need the guttural chanting and like atonal noise placed on top of black screen or punctuating certain moments out of nowhere like horror movie jump scares? I mean, it feels like another case of not trusting the audience to me. I actually think this film with this aesthetic would have benefited without any scoring at all, with just no music, just sound. There's a handful of chilling moments. I think Glazer is too skillful. He's not a hack at all. So it's not going to be a film that is not going to have anything of merit in it. I think the scenes that involve the children, and this is where I get back to if this is centered on them, I think it would be more provocative. But like the children hearing prisoners being punished, not really knowing how to process that, or playing with loose teeth of the deceased, mm-hmm. are probably, to me, those are the most affecting moments, because these are children, these are characters that aren't fully formed yet. They are not buying into the system. They're just there with, you know, they didn't get to choose this, and they're the psychology of the trauma that's going to be inflicted upon them as they learn through history what's going on is something that stuck with me. But following Rudolph and Hedwig doesn't really bring anything of interest to me. This is not a case of the banality of evil to me. And I do admire the final sequence where Rudolph wanders through a series of descending stairs and darkened hallways, which you could almost view as a leap through time, which does culminate in the ending Christian and Armando where you guys were alluding to, that I think, you know, when you get to the ending where it's the modern day museum, Auschwitz Museum, I think it's just emphasizing the absence of the victims in a way I found somewhat provocative. I mean, here's a film where through the entirety of it, you haven't seen the victims. You haven't seen any of this. And then when you get to the end, you see like the shoes and you see like the some of the torture devices that were used, but the victims are still absent, right? It's just the remnants of what was. So I think that was kind of, to me, a little bit more pressing and provocative than what the thesis of the entire film, like Armando said, was doing for an hour and 40 minutes. It was basically just what it did at the end again. But I think in the end, I think it was more effective for me. But it just kind of tied into what the film had been doing the whole time. So, yeah, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway is probably that systematic atrocity must regain a sense of normalcy in order to survive. But I didn't find that to be much of a revelation. Like in order for seemingly normal people to perform evil acts, they have to believe that these acts aren't actually evil, but part of a larger apparatus or a larger system. It's a survival mechanism. And I think this is an obvious point that Glazer stretches beyond the breaking point, while also in the process drawing attention to the aesthetic to the degree that distanced me or detached me or made me think too much about what was being done rather than what was actually being done, if that makes sense. So this is probably the biggest disappointment of 2023 for me, because this I had on track as probably being an easy, like, you know, easy top 10 contender. And I think it's a movie worth discussing, worth seeing. I would tell people to see it, but it did not work for me.
Wow. Whoa. Okay. Oh, man.
Moderating Mondo in the middle again.
Yeah, I know.
We're fulfilling our roles here.
No, it's cool when even if I end up in familiar terrain, that's a familiar role that we're, it's a rarity where we're all kind of on different pages, because I edge kind of slightly positive. It didn't work for Jericho. Christian loved it, but I think you both make great points, and I don't necessarily disagree wholeheartedly with Christian. I think the big theme is the banality of evil, and I think it's fairly well done here. I mean, I think some of the criticism that Jericho had, I share to a degree, but I think they maybe took him out or drew attention to themselves too much. I didn't mind those. I mean, in a way, I saw the method. And I was fine with it. I'm not speaking for Jericho here that he needed a certain thing out of it. You know, I didn't need to feel the visceral effect of the atrocities, what's represented. It's already there. Like, this film is going into this in a different way, and I was fine with that. I just think that for me, it didn't hold up over a full 105 minutes. I felt it was kind of, you know, quite simply, it's like, I get the point. I get it. It's, you know, and as far as any, we've had moments of, you know, maybe I think this film stands out in a way because if you talk about banality of evil movies, maybe this one sets the standard where we've only gotten it in little moments here and there. And this is extended. It's pretty much the whole movie. And there was a resting.
Is it actually a banality of evil that's being expressed? Because isn't being banal, pedestrian, or commonplace, or boring, or just conventional?
As far as their actions
might be mundane, but they're not banal people because they're working. The guy works in the camp. Like, he is profiting off of the system. It's not a banality of evil situation. Now, if you focused on the kids or another family, I just think it's the focus here doesn't lend credence to the banality of evil for me.
I mean, this film is almost like you could take a painting, make a painting of one of the shots, right? And that's the movie, right? Like, the garden, two people having tea, smoke in the background. That's the film, right?
Right.
This could have been like a all-timer kind of short film, right? And like you said, he's too talented a filmmaker. There's going to be flourishes throughout that you're it's not going to drag for more than too long at a time before you're like, oh, I want to say pretty cool with this thematic, you know, but I mean, this could have been like an all-timer kind of distinct short film, or, you know, but I just felt like, yeah, you know, I could have gotten a canvas of this and I would have gotten the point.
I think the banality of evil question that's come up here, maybe that's a misnomer to apply that to this movie without modification. But what I mean, I don't know what anybody else, but what I mean by that in this, maybe tweaking that a little bit, is the banality of the lives of evil people. Like, I understand, like, the Rudolf Hess and Hedwig are not banal people, but their lives are still at times, at large stretches of times, arguably very simple and basic and routine and boring. Yeah,
I agree.
It's how does someone go? And it's a little bit different even between the two of them, because I don't know if Hedwig is directly firsthand responsible. I don't know what lays at her feet directly in a culpability sense. Obviously, she's a part of this whole machine, of course, but Rudolf Hess like goes out and makes decisions and does things that are so directly one-to-one impactful in these horrific ways. But that's what I was getting at when I was saying before, like, but then he goes home and eats a pot roast and like massages his wife's feet or whatever. And for me, and of course mileage will vary, but for me, that's something that, while not being a revelation, I find it useful to have that depiction, honestly, just for the change of pace of it. I don't think, watching hundreds of movies a year, there's a lot of depictions of evil people in this kind of way. I think it's very rare for someone to attempt or follow through or commit to showing horrible people in this type of way, and that variety is something that's important to me and connects with like real, like, since I've watched, there's, you know, you've seen horrifying things on Instagram or TikTok or whatever every fucking day, but like a photo going around just recently of like an Israeli soldier like celebrating their birthday with the Palestinian hostages in the background. Just this idea of people doing horrendous things, having other facets of the light of their lives that are directly comparable and relatable to us. I don't know. Maybe it's obvious for me. I welcomed the reminder of that. I don't think that's something we get enough of. Maybe that point is made in one long breath over the course of an hour and 45 minutes. So I understand that it may be wearying to get that point over and over again. I actually really like, Armando, your take of, you take a still of this movie, and that is kind of the, that's kind of the movie encapsulated. That's a great point. But I don't know. I think that including this in Holocaust stories, in stories of evil, in movies that ask you to question the depiction of violence that really happened or so similar to stuff that's really happening, taking this approach, I found valuable. The other aspect, you know, is just, can't really argue or bring up, like Jericho talking about the aesthetics of this, you know, pulling you out or being distracting. Like, for me, that kept me engaged, because while a lot of this is so routine, I felt like, knowing Jonathan Glazer and even some elements of this movie, like, anything could be possible, which I feel like was answered in some ways with the thermal sequences and that like cut to a red screen at one point and the last sequence of the movie. I never felt comfortable even in the repetitiveness of the movie, because I felt like something could happen at any moment, even if it was just stylistically and not depicting the atrocities of Auschwitz. But obviously that's just gonna it's kind of entirely subjective.
Yeah, I mean, it was, anytime something like that happened, I was like, okay, here we go, right? And and here again, I'm literally moderating between you and Jericho's ends of the spectrum, but I will remember this film. You do make good points. It's like, it's, you know, think of every Holocaust movie we've ever seen, and the commander or whatever take them, and then it's like, well, what if we went home with them? This is that film, mm-hmm. right? What's his wife up to? Showing her mother or his whoever's mother it was the variety of flowers and vegetables, and as we hear the agonizing screams and smokes of people being incinerated in gas, like within that context, doing something different. So
yeah,
there's that.
I just feel like because it's focused on these specific characters, they have an incentive to. We can go down the whole road of what the morality is and how heinous they are, but there's an incentive for them to block that out, right? Like a financial incentive. Like it's building their life they always wanted, right? So mm-hmm. it's not exactly the same as just someone being complicit or like seeing something that's terrible and then choosing to turn the other way or to ignore it. I'm choosing to ignore this because it's actually benefiting my family. And I think the idea maybe is to say, well, you could be that Nazi officer. Like if circumstances were different, you could be that person. I don't think the film for me didn't land that point. It's kind of like these people, and even the wife to a large degree, because she's completely on board and aware of what's, I mean, she's not like directly doing anything, but she's a part of that structure. So this apparatus has to keep moving in order for us to have the life that we want. So I think that that's pretty much right what the film is getting at, which I don't find that revelatory. Like, I feel like that is how all these heinous, racist, genocidal systems work. They have to work that way. Otherwise, they fall apart, right? These people have to live in this way. Maybe it's not depicted in media and in films, so I guess it's novel for that. But beyond that idea, what else is it bringing? What else is there to talk about or to investigate with this film? I think it's and aesthetics aside, I feel like we don't need him to jump in and do the under the skin stuff. I think if you're going to do this, take that out, strip it back even more. I mean, we don't need the horror music and the red screen and all that. Like, why is that here? Like, it just to make you feel uncomfortable. I mean, it already is uncomfortable. So it felt like he didn't quite trust. He wanted to be distanced from the material, but then he also wanted to manipulate through these more artsy means, and it just kind of it just doesn't work, you know, with and I really feel like the subject matter, like obviously this movie would never be nominated for any awards if the Holocaust wasn't involved in some way, like the way this is done and shot, this is not but it has the automatic kind of appeal, and I just find it interesting, this isn't a problem, but that someone like Spielberg was criticized so heavily for the red dress scene or the sappier sentimental moments or moments where he was about to show something horrible and didn't. And then someone like Glazer is mostly universally praised for doing what he's doing here, but then using very manipulative artsy aesthetics to achieve his ends, and it's just like the inverse of what Spielberg's doing. But I feel like Schindler's List to me is a more truthful film about this subject, even if it has those more movie-ish moments, right? This just feels like an art installation without any kind of feeling at all behind it.
And that's a good way to put it, but and I think to Christian's point a little bit, I know we keep to beat a dead horse with the banality of evil thing. I think it is affecting that sense to a degree, which became kind of repetitive and not particularly like illuminating to me by the end of it. But like you're right, they're benefiting from this. But that's the whole point. It's so transactional. There's no right? I mean, I don't think there's no scene of him going on this vile tirade about, you know, those dirty Jews or something like that, right? You know, there's this odd, you know, it's completely transactional and practical for them, right? There's no thought process. There's no wrestling with it. You get the couple of Hail Hitlers in there, but there's no like, oh, this is God's mission or anything, self, you know, delusion, right? Or justification. It just feels purely transactional and the artifice of the juxtaposition of the what's going on in the foreground versus the background, I thought was to a degree effective. And then, it's also, you know, I don't know if this is kind of like in his, gradual Anwar unraveling sort of things leading up to that, that heaving or the actual vomit. But there, you know, then you get this moment where he's at some banquet or some dinner, right? This elite kind of a thing. And he's like calling home and she doesn't really care to talk to him, really. It's obvious, right? She just wants things to keep on rolling for her lifestyle. And he's just calling and he says something about how he was, it just struck me as odd. I couldn't know quite what to make of it. He's just like, I was just thinking about how to gas this whole place, right? which was interesting, but yeah, I mean, it's an interesting entry into this type of film, I suppose, overall.
I do appreciate the moment where he kind of like, he has his, you know, fling with the Jewish mistress or whatever, sequence, and he kind of goes to wash up. He goes and washes up before.
There's little things
like that where it's like, okay, there we're getting at something else here. So I think there's little moments that are kind of instructive, and anything with the kids, I thought that stuff was the most interesting.
With the toys and
But like following him to business meetings and the bureaucracy. I mean, any of these systems, that's how they operate. It's not a bunch of guys sitting around like, you know, screaming epithets and like, you know, it's like business. It's a business. Yeah. It's a business thing. How big are these ovens? And it's horrifying, right? But how could this thing go on as long as it did without it being like that? So, I mean, that's, I guess, displaying that is noteworthy in and of itself, but that's it, right? I mean, that's really all this movie is. So it just didn't. Yeah, I guess
it's really surprising that doesn't seem valuable at all. I don't know.
It's not valuable. I just think it's.
Well, you didn't get much out of it. Valuable to you. Like you didn't get much out of that.
Not really.
I don't know. I guess. And I keep coming back to this idea of like the comparison of it. Because again, it's not like, oh, I learned something while watching this. But there's a scene early on in the movie, similar to what you guys are talking about, like, oh, we're talking about like the plans for these gas chambers. And there's like blueprints out on like a coffee table or something. It's been like a month since, so I might not have all the specifics right. But they're like talking about it. This is early on in the movie, and it's so boring and flat and uninteresting. The part that was like galling for me was Rudolph isn't wearing any shoes. He's just like barefoot. He's just got his like tall socks up as they're like discussing gas chambers or whatever the specifics were. And granted, like not the greatest point any artist has ever made, but for me, I don't see this a lot. I'm not shown often the ideas that these horrible people are so plain and boring. It reminded me actually that scene in particular reminded me of a scene in Oppenheimer, which I also really liked, where it's towards the end of the film and I think nearing the completion or at the completion of the bomb, and there's that fucking general or whomever, and they talk about not bombing Kyoto because him and his wife had their honeymoon there, so they're not gonna bomb that city and kill, you know, thousands and thousands of people. That kind of flippancy with doing something so heinous really hit me. And the zone of interest is kind of that feeling for like 90% of it, which again, I can understand that being wearying, but I don't know why that seems like an important point to make or something that means something to me while watching that moment in Oppenheimer, and a lot of similar emotions like that, I think, happen in the zone of interest. I don't know if I can fully explain why that is a thing for me, but also the idea of these characters, the main characters, getting something out of this, that was also a point I appreciated too, because the complicity that I think the zone of interest gets at is not to say, hey, everyone's like a Nazi in their own way, but I think there are compromises and that people do make or are very willing to make if there's a personal gain that happen all the time. The people benefiting from unfair systems or even the participation of capitalism, or how some people are supported and others aren't, whatever. Like, there's all these different decisions that could be made economically, through work, through where you live, how you live, all these different things, where if there's a benefit to you and your family, you're more willing to overlook or allow things, even if you know they're terrible. I don't know. That was a worthwhile pointing of the finger for me as well in the zone of interest, like considering the ways in which people are willing to overlook for personal gain. I don't know. That wasn't a drawback for me. That was also something I appreciated in how it was depicted.
But one person didn't the ground, like, she had to leave. She was just, I don't know.
I was really fascinated by that, because she leaves a letter and Hedwig reads it and burns it immediately.
Yeah, I think we have to surmise what it was about, right? Like, yeah.
Because I think there's two big reads. I think initially I thought, oh, she had a problem with this and she had to leave. But then the more I thought about it, I literally think that it was the smell. Like, the smell was overpowering. She couldn't stomach it. So she, like, physically couldn't handle it, not morally couldn't handle it.
Either way, it's also, just one last note. Speaking of, like, what does this mean? Rudolph, after they're swimming early on, getting out of the lake or whatever, just that side shot of him with the semi, like, what was going on there with Rudolph? What is he doing? I don't know if you guys noticed that, but
that could have just been me. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you don't remember that shot?
I don't remember.
He's just kind of leaning back. He's got the dad bod going on. He's just kind of surveying, and he's like, clearly there's like this. Anyways, not relevant, but why is it in there? I don't know.
I haven't heard it. There's been no think pieces on Rudolph's semi-erection during while playing in a polluted river with his kids or whatever. I don't think that's ever been broached. So you might be the first one that's even
out. That's probably the perfect note to end this conversation on, right? I think that's the one that brings us home. Gonna do it. Good job getting glazed, everybody. That's the zone of interest. Thanks everyone for hanging out with us. I feel like we were kind of in three different positions on this one. So, listener, if you've got
three different zones, if you will.
Three different zones for the each of us. So, listener, if you've got some thoughts, if you fall in one of these options, let us know. Email the show, thethirdactpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on social media, namely Instagram. It's the best way to keep up with us. And I don't even know what we're going to be doing next. We've got to talk about a 2024 movie eventually. We've been talking about 2023 movies. We've been talking about TV. But eventually, we've got to watch a 2024 movie. I know Jericho hated Dune, so I guess Dune 2 is not going to be the one.
I didn't hate Dune.
I thought you liked it or mixed on it. I don't know.
I gave it a 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd.
Okay.
So not hate. That's not a hate. But I was disappointed, but I have personal reasons because I'm a very big fan of the book. But speaking of 2024, why are we going to Dune when we got the Wenders coming down the pike here?
We do, if that becomes widely available, that's definitely something of interest. Something I've looked at and wanted to watch for months because I didn't really fully understand the release
back for that because he's a big Wenders guy. So we might be able to get Armando back, and we could hit a Wenders blind spot, an old Wenders film plucked from the vault.
Mondo, you on the hook for Wenders?
Only if we all pronounce it Wenders, everybody. No, I don't know. I'm big time into that. The trailer has me a little,
Armando worried.
Worried. Is this a little too heartfelt? A little too the movie we need now energy. life affirmed. But not to be a cynic. Where Wenders has rarely taken a wrong turn, so I'm definitely in the bag for that.
Say Wenders? You didn't even say Wenders. You said Wenders.
I gave up the game. Yeah, it's Wenders. Wenders.
I don't think I've seen a trailer for the Wenders. I just
it's huge. It's called Perfect Days. It's got the lyrics on Perfect Day blasting on. It's the cosmos. You gotta check it out.
Okay. I can't tell if you're messing with me. All right. So Wenders maybe, Dune maybe. I mean, guys, it's late. I don't even have time to give you my Madam Web review, but I did see Madam Web for the meme. For the lulz.
Panderverse.
It was bad. Panderverse. It was bad. It was really bad. That's the one sentence review. All right. Let's get out of here. That's going to do it. Thanks, everyone. And remember that the greatest act of all is the third act of the rest of our lives. Make the best of it and have a good night.